Professors FM.
Okay, my name's Mike Lewis. I'm joined by Doug Battle, and this podcast is about fandom. And so, Doug, you know, the reality is we've been doing this for a couple years now, and there's a little bit of malpractice going on, I think, if we really think this through, because there is only one fandom in the United States of America at this point, and everyone else is living in Taylor Swift's shadow. So she rolled out to a Chiefs game. That was the number one TV broadcast of the week. I think 25 million people increased the TV ratings in the female 18 to 49 age group by, I think, 60 or 70%. Suddenly, a spike in Chiefs ticket sales. Kelce's jersey is probably the rate. I'm sure there's going to be a massive number of TikTok videos at the end of the week when those jerseys ship.
There's also going to be some jerseys burned when this inevitably flames out.
So, Doug, we've never talked about Taylor Swift fandom, and I think you could argue that the Swifties are the number one fandom in the world, right? I mean, they stood up Ticketmaster. They took on Scooter Braun, right?
Yeah.
Swifties roll out, maybe not, you know, literal hands, but they're willing to throw figurative hands. They dress up. They put on outfits to go to the concert. They pay thousands of dollars. And so, you know, you SEC football fans, you actually have a new role model.
I'm impressed. I've said it all year long. Like, we've mentioned them from time to time saying, you know, top fandom, the sports fans pale in comparison. You look at the concerts and the friendship bracelets and the outfits, wardrobes, and seeing the collision of two fandom worlds this week between NFL football, the most like male dominant fandom in the world, and the Swifties. And the Swifties all of a sudden becoming football fans pulling for the Chiefs. I'll say this, Mike, the Chiefs, we've seen them escalate up the fandom rankings, your annual fandom rankings over the last, I don't know, 5 years. largely due to Patrick Mahomes and the rise of that team as a whole. But man, I can't imagine what the numbers look like if Travis Kelce locks in Taylor Swift. Okay. If he were to put a ring on that finger in addition to a couple more Super Bowl rings, that might be one of the top fandoms statistically in the country.
Okay. And I think I'm a marketing professor, and I'm going to be the first one to admit that you do not need a degree to be a great marketer. I don't know Taylor Swift's educational background, but she clearly has the pulse of large segments of America. And if she just rolled out there for the publicity, that wouldn't surprise me either. I mean, she's a master. She's an absolute master at what she does. Now, let me throw something else out at you. You know who missed the boat in all this?
No, who?
Major League Baseball.
Oh,
why couldn't Major League Baseball have engineered something like this?
Mike Trout and
Mike Trout. It doesn't even matter. Whoever baseball, and this is the killer, right? Who's baseball's glamour? Who's baseball's Derek Jeter or A-Rod or whoever? Can you imagine, like, if baseball had done this, like one of these guys in a pennant chase?
That would have
been epic.
America's pastime. And I don't think it's manufactured per se, but I think it would be smart too. Like, I think people, it's kind of like Barbenheimer. I felt like that was an organic thing, but they might in the future, if you're a movie studio, you might try to schedule your release, you know, the same day as some polar opposite blockbuster. This is like Barbenheimer to me. Like, it's a phenomena. The tweets have been hilarious. Lots of memes. Girls, you know, analyzing star signs between the two to see if they're compatible, and sports fans looking at it and being like, this is like pretty much you and I, we're not all that different. Like, we go way in the weeds to bring out analysis to try to figure out, you know, if something's going to work or not in terms of the season for us and for you, the relationship.
Have you seen I gather there's a TikTok trend where women will say to, and again, how much of this is staged, right? Where young women will say to typically older men, Taylor really did a favor for that Travis guy. She put him on the map, and the guy inevitably reacts with, "Are you kidding? He's the greatest tight end of all time."
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Travis Kelce.
Hold on, Doug. They even, I think, badgered your guy, Brock Bowers, into a comment about how this was a win for tight ends.
I'm thinking like Brock, I mean, what are you going to say? But you look at, it's like, I wonder if he's sitting there thinking like, I wonder if like it'll be me and like Olivia Rodrigo or some like other pop star. That's going to be how it works for tight ends now. Because he called it a win for tight ends. And I found it kind of funny how enamored like the team, the sideline was when you would see shots of everyone elbowing each other, like looking up at the booth, she's actually here.
Thing to her.
Yeah. It's like, these are professional athletes. Like these are guys that have people coming up and have had people coming up asking them for autographs for their entire lives. And this one girl shows up at a football game and they all turn into little boys
Who is the second biggest star in America?
Beyonce.
Is it? I mean, I think
her fandom is like similar.
No. I really don't know. I think maybe we have one star in America right now, and that's Taylor Swift. And I don't know who, maybe Beyonce's number two, but God, it's a drop off.
Yeah. I mean, Taylor, there's no doubt she's marketing like brilliance. And it's like everything she does, she can't lose. Like she gets in a relationship and it doesn't work out, she gets the hit song. Everyone finds all the dirt on the guy, you know, which, like I said, inevitably Travis Kelce has to be a little nervous about, you know. And then if it ever works out, it'll be the fairy tale and everyone will be, you know, her wedding will be the event of the century in totally pop culture.
Yeah.
And so it's like she can't lose. And I know everyone's saying like Travis Kelce's the big winner right now. I don't know. I'm a little nervous for Travis.
Yeah. He's in over his head because everyone would be over their head, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's almost like if you watch like interviews from him, like, I don't know, a year ago, and he's talking about her, it's almost like this challenge for him to get her to go out with him or to like notice that he exists. And now he like found himself in an actual apparently relationship where she's in the booth with his mom, dropping the F-bomb on TV, by the way. And again, she can't lose. People thought that was awesome.
Yeah. And again, let's come back to the fact that I think they did 24.5 million viewers of that game, which is,
I think I have more friend girls than guy friends that watched that.
Okay, but 24 or 25 million people is better than the World Series or the NBA championship does. And so look, it's the NFL.
Just to see a person in the crowd.
Right. So Taylor, if MLB had, you know, had one of their star play, what do you kids say, Doug? Be thirsty, you know, expressing his thirst for Taylor Swift for a couple of
years.
That's
the correct
term. Okay, well, I don't. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, whatever I mean to say, well, let's just pretend I'm getting the
Riz, maybe.
You know, I mean, she could have conceivably doubled the World Series TV ratings if she had shown up for, you know, Mike Trout or whoever with a poster child for a poster boy for MLB, what it might be.
I'm still so upset because now it'd be even more perfect. I've been thinking all year because of the Eras Tour and the Phantom and all that, that it would be the perfect year for Taylor Swift to do the Super Bowl halftime show. And they just announced that Usher is going to.
She's too big.
She's too. I mean, the rumor is she turned it down.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know how that works. But I mean, can't you just see
200 million people watching it, I think.
Well, I mean, most, I would think the majority, the viewership would drop drastically after halftime. For the show. But I mean, I'm imagining like a Chiefs game with Travis Kelce on the field and maybe even a recently split Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift where she's singing about him on the stage.
No.
Like, I mean, it's just like, it's too good. And I'm still bummed that it didn't happen this year. I hope they get her next year. I don't know what, like, it is. It does feel like she's too big for the Super Bowl halftime show. And it's never felt like that ever for an artist.
And again, we haven't talked about Taylor Swift fandom, and maybe this podcast is only going to be about Taylor Swift as soon as the NFL season. difference.
I will add this. If Taylor Swift, I think one concern on the NFL side might be the Taylor Swift fans are so much superior to NFL fans in terms of how dedicated they are, and they are dedicated, that if she did the halftime show, the whole stadium would be bought out by Swift fans who had no interest in the football game and show up to the Super Bowl in their outfits and their friendship bracelets solely to watch the halftime show and leave at halftime.
I will say this. You know, I put some Taylor Swift fandom data out on the fandom analytics website. So people can take a look at that, looking at where they, you know, the sort of politics and Taylor Swift fandom, religion, and actually even one slide or one picture looking at football fandom and Taylor Swift fandom. And I think you're right, Doug, that the best plot twist would be if there was a breakup maybe the week before the Super Bowl. Right.
It's a distraction. All the interviewers asking about it, man.
But you know,
it's too good.
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, I don't want to move to college football just yet. But you know, you're right. Like this idea of like the right plot twist in terms of like a breakup, and in terms of how that just makes, you know, the stories just write themselves.
Yeah.
As I'm watching the NFL last week, and you know, there was another guy on the field that I talk about a lot, you know, on the other sideline besides the Chiefs, Justin Fields, and you know, Zach Wilson and the Broncos coach. I mean, some of the stories, you know, some of the most compelling NFL stories at this point in the season are guys that are really struggling. You know, and I'll start with Fields because, you know, for years I've been talking about how it's amazing the media coverage he gets. I think the media is starting to turn on him. And
you Mike. You've called this for so long. I thought he was going to be I'll own it. I thought he was going to be a league MVP at some point when he was drafted, if he stayed healthy.
The story just got better, right? Because now sort of the back against the wall with, you know, maybe just a few games left to turn this around, this story just got incredibly interesting to me. And you know, Fields came out, said some dumb stuff about coaches, and I think the problem is, you know, Fields may develop a reputation as a coach killer and all this,
right?
But now when I'm looking at the Zach Wilson story and the Justin Fields story, these are interesting things, right? I mean, what was Wilson taken second in the draft? I think
he was taken over Fields,
you know,
and
that
Trey Lance.
Now the pile on in terms of Wilson is amazing, right? I mean, Joe Namath coming out and saying that he should be playing. You know what Zach Wilson's record as a starter is?
Like 500, maybe
8-14. Okay. You know what Justin Fields is?
Like 3-25 or something.
I think it's 5-23.
Yeah.
And if you look at the, let me see if I can find.
I think Trey Lance is a 0-0.
Yeah.
He might have started at some point.
Well, and I'm not going to try and find it. I was looking at some of the passer ratings right now, 3 weeks into the season. Wilson and Fields are right next to those. And Wilson is actually ranked above Fields.
Yeah.
So to me, this is compelling drama. And, you know, maybe neither of these guys is going to have much of a future after this. But it's interesting to see these guys with their backs against the wall and see how they respond going forward.
I'm at a point with Justin Fields where I've given up on him as a quarterback. If I'm the Bears, I think he's still a valuable asset if you can teach him how to play like any other position. He's the best athlete on the field. He's not a good quarterback. Like, put him at running back. Just use him in the wildcat. Put him at tight end. Might be one, you know, if he has hands at all, he's going to be unstoppable. Put him at safety. Put him at, like, there's a million things. But that's how I've been with Anthony Richardson coming in the league, where I'm like, shoot, everyone views it as this boomer bust thing. I think it's like a boomer, you know, decent thing where it's like he could be a really good tight end, I think. I think there's a number of positions he could be a great football player at.
Bottom five quarterbacks in the league at this point. Fifth from the bottom, Bryce Young.
That didn't surprise me. Yeah,
guys struggle.
Right.
Kenny Pickett. I don't think I have heard the nickname Kenny Pickoff. You know, I don't think he takes as much heat as you might think from what the stats look like.
There's still some like optimism with Kenny Pickett. You're two.
Ryan Tannehill, third from the bottom.
Yeah, that's one that
I like that one. You and you know why I like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to tell him why?
Because
who's waiting in the wings, Mike?
I want to see Will Levis on the field. Okay.
Is there any buzz about that? I haven't heard his name since like
Levis? I don't think so.
Just the offseason.
Third stringer, right? So
yeah, like because they got Malik Willis too.
Yeah. Zach Wilson, second from the bottom, and Justin Fields bottom in terms of QBR stat.
Yeah, and he's I mean those two I just think that draft class, I think there's after all the buzz, there's one legitimate franchise quarterback that came out of the class.
Yes. And one journeyman, it looks like. I mean, are we going to call Mac Jones a journeyman?
Sure, yeah. I think he could be like a Ryan Tannehill, you know? Like, I guess he can start for a lot of teams. Just no one's dying to have him. He's not Justin Herbert. Everyone pretended he was Justin Herbert for a year because his team wasn't terrible. But, yeah, because he was – remember on your QB wins, was he like a minus one or like a zero?
Which one are we talking about?
Mac Jones after year one.
Yeah, I mean he was very good for a first year player. He was like a minus one, and most of these guys coming in about minus three in terms of their win contribution.
Yeah,
so he was well above average for. But again, you know, we got to look at these as probably quarterback coach pairs. I mean, but he seems like a decent, solid NFL starter, perhaps.
Can I say with Fields, the argument that we've heard for 3 years now about how the coaches are completely inept and the front office is completely inept and that's all it is. Like I can't, it was like that at Georgia and then at Ohio State, it was like, see, but you look at who else had success at Ohio State, right? These other QBs that didn't succeed in the NFL. It seems like that offense is generous to the elite arms, elite runners, and maybe doesn't develop their decision-making too much.
And maybe Ohio State has better talent than everyone else in the Big Ten.
Right. Right. Which helps, which certainly helps. But, I mean, I'm not going to lie. Fields looked like the real deal against Clemson in that playoff game. Like, he looked unbelievable. I thought he was a better Cam Newton. I did.
I mean, Fields is the eye test, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I get where they're coming from, but at this point, what is he on his like third coaching staff or second coaching staff? I mean, he's played for like four or five coaching staffs in the last five. If you go back to college,
and this,
it's all but the, you know, all but the Ohio State stint, it's been a pretty epic failure.
One of the things I really kind of have a problem with the sports media, right? Where these guys will get up there and they will all talk about how, you know, the Bears coordinators or coaches staff don't seem to be interested in putting Fields in a position to win, right? Yeah. They are neglecting his talents and trying to put him into a different system. And look, Doug, I have to think that whoever the offensive coordinator for the Bears is, whoever the previous ones were, you know, it keeps him up at night trying to figure out how to use his running talents,
right,
and his arm to do it. That's all they think about, right?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you start to play that game where you're like, because I've said for a long time, I'm like, Fields is Jalen Hurts plus. Like, you put him in the Eagles system, he's got a better arm, better wheels, bigger guy. But, you know, for whatever reason, I'm starting to doubt my own take there, because there's the decision-making is what separates quarterbacks in the NFL. The fact that, like, a Jacob Eason, who has the best arm I've ever seen in person, isn't even in the NFL at this point. You know, and he's what, 3-4 years in to his, you know, to when his career would be happening. It's all about decision making. That's what separates these guys and leadership, which Jalen Hurts may not be an elite passer. He's an elite leader in the NFL. And I think that's one thing that set him apart from being that kind of like journeyman backup to being like a Pro Bowl starter. And Justin Fields, I think, clearly lacks that quality. And I don't know, but I do know that like with Fields, there's been the argument of, oh, it's just the coaches. You do not hear that with Zach Wilson. I have never heard it. And I don't think either is a friend. I'm not saying that's the case with Zach Wilson, but for whatever reason, he's never gotten the benefit of the doubt that Fields has gotten. Like from day one, it's been, this guy's not an NFL quarterback.
Oh, I mean, look, I've been watching Talking Heads all week, and it seems to be that he's got the, you know, in some ways, the criticism is the same of both guys, right? That they've got the arm, they've got the mobility, but they are lacking the processing speed.
Yeah. Perhaps. Yeah.
But yeah, look, the tone is so different between those two players. And I mean, Some of it probably has to do with the nature of the media in those two cities. Some of it has to do with the fan bases. I mean, look, when the Jets fans think they are going to the Super Bowl with Aaron Rodgers for a couple of times, and then suddenly they're back to this rookie quarterback that washed out after this previous rookie quarterback, Sam Darnold, washed out. You know, the frustration is brutal, where in the case of the Bears, Doug, who was the last great Bears quarterback before Justin Fields?
In my opinion, there hasn't been one.
Okay. And so, you know, Chicago fans might go Jim McMahon in 1985. I don't know that McMahon.
Great team, but.
It's great.
Nobody knows who McMahon is if he didn't play with that defense.
Yeah. And so that's where you end up with that. Fields is a more physically talented quarterback than the Bears have ever had. And so, you know, this asymmetry in terms of hope across those two fan bases. But again, you know, Justin seems like he's going to talk his way into a lot of trouble here.
He's done it before. He knows how to make enemies.
Yeah.
He knows how to make enemies. So, yeah, I don't know with him. He's a guy that it's like, I wouldn't really want him as my backup. Like I said, I want him to be my starting running back or my starting linebacker or my starting tight end. I don't know if I want him as a backup because of how he's handled such a role in the past. The infamous video of him saying, ironically, that he handed the ball off really well after Georgia beat South Carolina in a game where a lot of people picked Georgia to lose, by the way, and he was ticked off after the game. And that resurfaced the internet this week and reminded me, this is not the guy you want as your backup quarterback. That is not going to be a healthy culture.
I think I know where you're going with it. And it's something that, and again, I think this is the interesting thing about Zach Wilson and Justin Fields. In psychology, there's something called thin slices research. Okay. I'm going to go in the weeds here for just a second. And it's remarkable, let's say, how quickly, if you just show people like 5-10 seconds of a teacher, a professor, you can do a pretty good job of predicting the student evaluations, right? There's just some sort of, you know, charisma or something, likability.
Using all the slang this week.
Yeah. And I think on both of those guys, I think that was sort of one of my red flags for Fields, is that his persona never quite seemed right. And I would say it's the same thing with Wilson, but they seem to come at it from different places. Wilson seems to come at it as, you know, almost a pretty boy that doesn't really care, just kind of happy to be there.
Like almost Johnny Manziel.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. And Fields always seems like he's on the verge of complaining.
Yes. Right? 100%.
Okay. And those are
And he's going to get his dad involved, inevitably. Exactly.
And I think that's – and again, the media treated them both very differently. But it seems – I mean, it's kind of interesting. Like, say, looking at these two guys at the bottom of the NFL, backs completely against the wall, probably the two most unhappy fan bases in the NFL. You know, it's – you know, sometimes the best stories are at the top of the league. Sometimes the best stories are at the bottom of the league. Right now, I'm fascinated to see how Chicago and New York play out over the next couple of weeks.
If I'm in the Fields camp, my biggest concern is a Colin Kaepernick / Tim Tebow situation where he goes from starter to not even in the NFL very rapidly because, like I said before, he's not the guy you want as your second string quarterback. You didn't want Tim Tebow because of all of the media attention that brought and I guess some would consider to be controversy and outspokenness on things that these teams don't want to bring attention to. And the same thing, different subject with Colin Kaepernick. Both guys went from starter to out of the league in no time. Fields, it's like, can't you see 5 years from now, Fields writing open letters to the Jets asking him for an open practice where he can showcase his skill, like what Kaepernick's doing now. I mean, he's not that far away.
I can see a documentary that no one watches. Right, they make, and then they realize that
he was in that high school documentary QB1. Maybe this one's like QB4.
Actually, you know, I mean, kind of that is kind of the perfect from QB1 and that Netflix show all the way to that. Yeah. Bears backup quarterback is a guy named Nathan Peterson, by the way.
Yeah, that's like a journeyman, never going to be a starter guy, which is like honestly the dream job. I'm not hating. That's what if I'm Justin Fields, like I'm a little envious of that, but because I don't think Fields is going to be that guy.
No. And look, if you sign contract two in the NFL at the quarterback position, Mitch Trubisky, you know, that's it's actually generational wealth. So you're dead right. That
yeah.
is a dream job.
Yeah. But again, I like Fields as an athlete. I like him as I like him as a developmental prospect for just about any position but quarterback at this point.
Okay, Doug, what else said? To me, those are the most compelling stories in the NFL. These kind of...
Well, I mean, we got to talk about those Miami Dolphins, Mike.
Okay, but you know what? Again, my take on that is as I'm watching that kind of going, okay, I mean, I guess I got two opinions about that. One, I will never forget the situation with Tua and the finger spasms, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that created so much doubt, and we all kind of, a lot of us kind of said, this is not going to work out. But that Denver team, and, you know, the, you know, what did the coach say, right? That the last year's coaching job was the worst he had ever seen in the NFL. And then the Dolphins roll out and put 70 points and 700 yards. Again, you know, great stories at the top and the bottom at the same time.
Yeah, Denver fans, I know Denver fans, and every year they feel like they're, for the longest time, they were a quarterback away, and they thought Russell Wilson last year was going to help them turn the corner. So at this point, beyond frustrated. And on the flip side, Miami Dolphins fans, who many people kind of wrote off Tua with the injuries, and I'm one who's, my stance on Tua has always been like it was with RG3, is if he can stay healthy, I think he's a star, and I'm concerned about him staying healthy. Not all that different from Bryce Young, although I'm less confident in Bryce Young than Tua. But if he can stay healthy, he's likely to be a star, particularly in this offense. So to see him go from kind of like Jalen Hurts last year, right? To go from questionable NFL starter, like is this guy going to be a career backup or a, you know, fringe kind of starting guy, like top 15 quarterback maybe, to is this guy going to be the MVP of the league overnight, is exciting for those fans. And Tyreek Hill, we talked about that maybe 2 years ago, the acquisition and saying, you know, it's a quarterback driven league. These guys, you can kind of surround them with whoever, and those guys will just become stars because the quarterback distributes the ball so well. And then, and of course, there's some truth to that in watching Kansas City go win a Super Bowl last year. But, you know, Tyreek Hill clearly bringing in and Jalen Waddle bringing some excitement to that Dolphins offense. They've created an identity, you know, a highest scoring team I've seen in a long time. Mike McDaniel kind of being the wonder kid of the NFL, and Tyreek Hill dancing with the fans in the literally in the stands, which was one of my favorite celebrations in NFL history. And I think that should be a new tradition. We've got the Lambeau leap. We've got, you know, we've got all these traditions in the NFL. I think every Dolphins player should follow suit, go up into the actual stands, row one, and pretend to be a fan for 15 seconds.
Okay, I'm in agreement with you. It's, you know, I saw some stat that, you know, in terms of top speed hit, in terms of, you know, running with the ball, the Dolphins absolutely dominate it. It looks like the Dolphins might have the four fastest players in the NFL,
right,
as receivers. So again, it's like, you know, kind of greatest show on turf kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's like watching the Lakers, but you know, like Showtime Lakers, like it's that kind of unique identity. That is a spectacle.
Okay, you got anything else on the Dolphins? Because I'm going to actually tell you my favorite coach in the NFL in a second here. So I want to let you finish your thoughts on the Dolphins.
I think that's it. I will just say if I'm a Dolphins fan, I am still concerned about Tua Tagovailoa's health based on his history.
Okay. So here's the quote. Squaring up Pete Carroll, he's a man I think I could easily defeat in hand-to-hand combat. Before the game, we shook hands and I whispered, let's leave the boys out of it and settle this mano a mano. Just brony, shirtless, with Kenny Loggins blasting over the stadium speakers. He just laughed and said, good luck, Dan. So we ended up playing the football game like effing cowards. Okay, so, you know, the Lions has come up as something that's got to be a sleeping giant of a fan base. Dan Campbell also has been out there publicly saying he wanted to have a live lion on the sidelines.
Yeah, this guy's electric.
We need the Lions to keep it rolling. We need them to win the NFC Central, now NFC North. We need the Lions to explode, to see what that fan base does with this maniac, this beautiful maniac at coach.
You know what's terrible about the Lions is I was about to say we need a Lions versus Dolphins Super Bowl, just, you know, maniac versus Wonder Kid. But I hesitated for a moment because I was like, wait, are the Lions in the NFC or AFC? And I couldn't remember because typically you remember that by which playoff games they've played in, whether they were in the NFC Championship or the AFC Championship. And with the Lions, I don't know how far back their history goes, but in my lifetime, I don't recall watching them in the playoffs. Maybe like one game with Stafford and Calvin Johnson, but it's like, what conference are they in?
Doug, let me just type it in because I looked it up and it's astonishing. Detroit Lions last playoff win. I want to say this is like in the early 90s, 1991.
Yeah, pretty brutal. Yeah, that's a starved fan base, but we've talked about how those types of droughts kind of breed passion.
Cold weather city.
Yeah.
Down economically. No.
And then I love that they got, they're such a blue collar team. Like they got a quarterback. They got like a, not the sexy guy at quarterback in terms of like when you're drafting a team on Madden, nobody's going and taking Jared Goff, right? When you're doing your fantasy draft, nobody's, he's not one of the big names.
I am. That,
Mike Lewis is, but you know, he's not a player that anyone's ever really been excited about in the NFL, and the Rams gladly parted ways with him. You know, he was, it felt like he was the weak link on a team that otherwise would have won a Super Bowl, and seeing him have a resurgence in Detroit where they embrace him and where he is the guy and where their offense has progressed leaps and bounds over the last 2 years. And so, and I see you're rocking the Lions colors over there, Mike. I know you.
Oh, unintentional.
or is it, you know, maybe subliminal.
Subliminal, yeah.
but yeah, all that to say is, you know, the Detroit Lions, this coach, I think he fits the culture in Detroit. And I think that, you know, with Goff and the group of players they have, they're a competitive football team, and if they were in any different uniform, people would be talking about them a lot more. If they were in a Chicago Bears uniform, if the Chicago Bears were playing at the level that the Detroit Lions are, we'd be hearing about them all the time.
If Dan Campbell was the Bears coach,
oh man,
they would be good. They would be reinventing the, you know, the Ditka skits. Yeah.
So it's like they're creating their own identity, their own culture, much like Miami is right now. For Miami, you know, first time since Marino, really, where there's been this level of excitement. And, I mean, there was a short stint with like Ronnie Brown when they invented the Wildcat. Yeah. I remember, you know, they beat the Patriots a time or two, but that was in the middle of Brady's reign. Nobody actually thought they were going to do anything. And so, yeah, first time since Marino for them. First time since what? Barry Sanders for Detroit?
Yeah, I mean, and Barry Sanders retired before you were born, right, Doug? I mean, it's...
Yeah, around there.
Yeah, I mean, so I just think it's interesting that you pulled out that name because I do think that is the, you know, and you probably know that name from playing Madden, right?
Oh, yeah. He was kind of an idol when I was a kid, even though. He was
the greatest Madden running back of all time.
Right? Yeah, yeah. I actually know him from a kind of cult classic game called Backyard Football, where they had children version of the NFL players playing against these made up children characters.
And, you know, nostalgia is such a great thing, right? Because I always get a little happy when I see Barry Sanders in the Heisman house. It's like because they never really let him be the star. It's usually like Tebow is getting most of the lines. But I love the guys
Baker
in the
Mayfield.
Yeah. Or like who's the big old running back from South Carolina that's making a ticky-tacky? What's funny about it? The Heisman house is Dr. Pepper, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And again, I wasn't even totally sure. So it's a beautiful advertising campaign that may be so well done that people don't even know what the product is.
It's almost more an advertisement just for college football as a whole.
And that's what Dr. Pepper has done, right? They've tried to really link themselves with that game.
Yeah.
Okay, college football, Doug. Again, to me, these stories all got better. I am so much more interested in Deion Sanders now than I was last week.
I disagree on that one. I can see, like, you personally, I don't disagree that you're more invested, but from like a national scale, I still will liken it to when a boxer is undefeated and it kind of loses the magic once they're a one-loss boxer. And I feel like he's a one-loss boxer now.
Yeah. So the sports media world lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, I guess I'm more of the guy that's interested in the old school 15 page or 10 page Sports Illustrated article than generating a bunch of clicks or impressions on X or Twitter.
Yeah.
And so this just became completely fascinating to me to see what happens next in this story. Because even like, you know, looking at now they have USC this week, right? And if you're thinking about the college, I mean, this is one of the dangers of the college football playoff system, right? If Oregon went out there and beat them down thoroughly, then does USC have to go out there and put a bigger beat down on Colorado for the college football poll voters?
I don't necessarily think so, because Oregon and USC will eventually play head to head. But I do think it's funny that people went from everyone's forgetting about this now. There were actual people talking about Colorado being a top four team, being a playoff team like a week ago. And so going from that to, hey, they actually, you know, they didn't win that much and they've achieved so much already. And they like trying to twist the narrative or find the moral victory in being on the field with Oregon or what may have happened out there. But my takeaway, my attention drifted quickly, and I think a lot of people's did, from Deion Sanders to a guy that I'm a huge fan of, Dan Lanning at Oregon. Of course, the infamous pregame speech saying, you know, we play for wins, not clicks, pretty much calling out Oregon or trying to motivate Oregon by calling out Colorado, you know, telling the players to talk with their pads, not with their mouths, not with their tweets, you know, just kind of old school guy. I mean, from that Kirby Smart coaching tree, Kirby Smart's from the Nick Saban coaching tree. So he's next in line over at Oregon. And after this week, I started hearing speculation.
He's next in line for Alabama?
Well, that's what the speculation is right now, that Alabama would kill to have him. And man, I got to say, as a Georgia fan, if that happens, my hat's off to Alabama, because I've long been a huge believer in Dan Lanning at Georgia. And so much so that when he left, I remember telling somebody that this is almost like, gosh, I hate that I'm saying this, but if Kirby Smart were to retire, I wouldn't be super mad about it, because we could have Dan Lanning for the next 30 years or whatever. I mean, he's very young. He's like a young Kirby Smart. He's a killer recruiter. He's very aggressive as a coordinator. He's a smart guy. He's got it now. I mean, he is just like the most primed for a job like that Alabama job of anyone I've seen in years. And people have talked about Dabo Sweeney. People have talked about various coaches. I've never been concerned about them. I've never felt threatened by the speculation of anyone other than Nick Saban. Dan Lanning terrifies me as a Georgia fan, you know, coaching anywhere in the SEC that's not at Georgia.
I mean, the issue with Coach Prime is that, you know, the previous coaches all kind of, and look, I'm not even going to blame these guys, because in some ways it's a battle you can't win, right? Because even if Colorado wasn't sort of talking smack, Colorado was talking. Right. I mean, the whatever they're doing with the watch, rolling around in Rolls Royces. I mean, they had it going on.
They set themselves up. It was so much like Tennessee last year before Tennessee played Georgia. It reminds me of that so much. But this was worse.
And so the coaches sort of have to respond to that in these press conferences.
Sure. Of course.
And Lanning, he did it beautifully. I mean, he did it very kind of tough. Right.
Tough,
I mean,
but not, it wasn't, he didn't make it personal. Like, he didn't give them ammo. They might have tried to make it into ammo, but
and if he did give them ammo, it was right before the game. So there was
They didn't see that. Yeah. Yeah. No, Colorado's players didn't see that. And I mean, I think Colorado lost long before that game, though. The way they've handled like success, or the little amount of success, has just been, it's been inevitable. Like I said, much like Tennessee last year, it's fun while it lasts. But you know it's coming. You know that like pride in sports comes before the fall every time when guys are doing this stuff. And I mean, very rarely. I remember feeling that way. Like, the one exception I can think of is Cam Newton at Auburn. I remember thinking it's coming for them. Like, they're not that good and they are talking and they are showboating. And we know how this ends when you play disciplined team, like at the time Alabama, at the time Oregon. They did it, and rarely do you see that. Colorado, of course, just they never did have the manpower to hang with the big boys, and so it really was inevitable. And much like that USC video of the infamous USC Alabama game, opening game of the year, where USC looks so eager to go out there and tear them up, and they look.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, it's where the USC players are on the ground, they're barking like dogs, like dog chains, like ready to go
and get beat by 70 points. And I saw Georgia did it to Alabama. There was a year when I was a student, Alabama ran on the field. Georgia players were right by where they were running on the field, yapping at them. 31-0 at half, or 31-3 at halftime, Alabama. I mean, that's just what happens in football, especially when you're the less talented team. So it's a story, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. It's a story we've seen before. Colorado's response has been interesting to me. Deion not being a sore loser in this presser, but also trademarking basically hashtags, you know, like we keep receipts. Like they're going to keep operating this way. His son, Shiloh, posted a highlight tape from the game of Shiloh making plays against Oregon, like the three times he actually made a play and didn't get destroyed, and posted on Twitter. So they're still doing their thing. They're still a social media juggernaut. They're going to continue operating the same way. They're not learning any kind of lesson, and I don't expect them to. I think this is who they are. I think this is how they're going to operate. And I think it's going to be pretty brutal when they lose, and they're going to get trashed on Twitter like they did this last week.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think the reality is that, and I think sometimes people forget, you know, and again, sports media, I think, almost pushes people to forget about this part of the story, right? That when you look at the talent on these respective sidelines, comparatively, Oregon is loaded, right?
Yeah.
And so when you put all the hype and all the media attention on the guys that aren't as good as the guys on your roster, yeah, Colorado does set themselves up for some interesting kind of conflicts on those fields. So again, what's the – Deion might bring all this excitement, right? All this excitement, all these thrills, packing out the stadium. But hasn't he also made it that every team on that schedule, you know how teams circle Alabama? Now teams are
Colorado circled. Colorado, yeah.
And they're being circled by teams that have much more talent on the roster. And so again, how does this play out? Deion's going to be great stories for the next several years. And I don't anticipate they're all going to be at Colorado.
I still anticipate Deion rides the wave of hype and recruiting, his recruiting potential to a bigger school, you know, to a Miami, to a Florida, somewhere where he can make even more noise, and that he's going to, again, continue operating. I likened him to a certain former president. I don't know if that was last week or 2 weeks ago, and how he operates and how he has this cult following. And it's so funny to me how, like, the friends I've talked to who are on the Colorado bandwagon and talked to after the game, and they're saying, man, you just don't know what would have happened if Travis Hunter had been out there. I just wish we could have been at full health so we could, you know, have seen like a fair contest. And also the whole like, well, you know, it's year one for us, and Deion's done a remarkable job, and everything he does is amazing, even when the outcome is what it was on Saturday. Okay, he can't lose in a lot of people's eyes.
Doug, and here's the thing, right? I mean, you mentioned recruiting. I just pulled up Colorado's 2024 football commits. Their overall rank is 75. So they're outside of the Power Five. And again, why this is going to be so interesting. Remember, what are you bringing, 86 players? Yeah. Maybe Deion isn't even really recruiting high school kids. Maybe he's going to bring in a class of
transfer portal, you
5 to 10 kids, and he's going to bring in 30. You know, who knows how many kids he's going to run off and how many he's going to bring in. He may be, and again, I was about to say reinventing. I don't know if that's fair, but he may be taking the current model and turning up the volume on it.
I think he will. And I think that's it. Again, former president, like he's flipping the way things have always been done. He's coming in with a fresh perspective. He's an outsider. Like he's not a football coach. Like he's not a lifelong football coach. He's almost more of a celebrity than a football player. I mean, of course he was a great football player, but he jumped straight to the head coaching ranks. I mean, to give you an idea, like Hines Ward, Super Bowl MVP Hines Ward, I believe he's a wide receivers coach for an NFL team. And he's slowly climbing the ranks. Like Dion, you know, he jumped right in. It's like he ran for president. He pulled a Kanye. He ran for president. He's not running for Congress. He's not running for his local treasurer. You know, he's running for president right out the gate. And he's coming at it with a completely fresh perspective, looking at things completely differently. It attracts a lot of people. And I do think he'll take advantage of things like the fact that when you bring in a bunch of freshmen, you know, it might be 2 or 3 years before they can contribute. And at a school like Colorado that needs a drastic turnaround, you're much more likely to have a quick turnaround when you're going through the portal.
And also, if you're not planning on being there for 5 years, you may as well bring in 21 and 22-year-olds rather than 18 and 19-year-olds.
Exactly. So, you know, if I'm a player, though, I want to play for Dan Lanning. I'm going to Oregon or wherever Lanning is. I just could not be more a fan of the way he does things. And my concern with him as a head coach after watching him as a DC was that most great DCs, what makes or breaks their head coaching career is who they give as their offensive coordinator and how dynamic of an offense because they tend to be risk averse and they tend to focus too much on the defense. And seeing Oregon, how creative they've been offensively, how they've turned around Bo Nix's career.
Yeah. I mean, that was the other great thing about Oregon, right?
Yeah.
And I totally associate Bo Nix with you because of all the talk about, you know, the amount of talk he's done about Georgia when he was at Auburn. And then also after one of the greatest moments of last year was really him talking smack about Georgia after losing to Georgia.
And then losing to Utah twice. Was it Utah? I don't forget. They lost to someone they shouldn't have lost to. USC lost to Utah twice. I get my Pac-12. They all beat each other.
And you know what, Doug? I think, you know, talk about a mismarking opportunity. They should have just stolen the old Bo Jackson, Bo Knows for Bo Nix's Heisman campaign.
Well, Auburn fans did that at Auburn. Like they did the whole Bo Knows thing. But here's my theory about college quarterbacks. Most of them stink out the gate, kind of like in the NFL. The difference is in the NFL, usually that after like year two or three, it's telling that they're just never going to be the guy. In college, it's like if you stick with a guy long enough, they almost always have a great senior year. like Stetson Bennett last year, Heisman candidate, was booed off the field on multiple occasions earlier in his career at Georgia. The fan base couldn't stand that guy. I mean, I've just seen it so many times now, seeing like DJ Uiagalelei get some buzz again now that he's not at Clemson. And it's like starting a guy as a freshman and then like kicking him out or like pressuring them out of town. I don't know if that's a winning strategy in football, where it's like I would almost rather always take the transfer quarterback that's going into his junior or senior year because they've already gone through their growing pains on the field, rather than take a kid that's, you know, going to be.
It's the old Parcells rules thing, right? That the idea is, you know, you never take a guy that hasn't basically started for 3 years, right?
Yeah, but like now you can do that in college. You could always have a fourth year starter on your team.
Right. But I mean, it's been one of the weird things about the whole quarterback market, right? In general, it's like these guys got so expensive. Right, this old idea of, well, we bring in a quarterback, we sit him for 3 years, Jordan Love, get him ready to play instead of throwing him to the wolves, that it's the repetitions and the practices and, you know, the idea that, again, how old was Stetson last year, Doug? 25? 24?
Yeah, 25, I think.
Yeah.
Right, he might have turned 26 during the season.
I mean, I'd rather have just the nature of that position.
And every game we played, it's like, you know, we would be playing – like if we played DJ Uiagalelei, you know, or we played, it's like, yeah, they got the better pro prospect, but I'd much rather have our 26-year-old out here. You know, his composure, it felt like that in every game with Stetson and watching Bo Nix and watching Georgia this year and feeling like, man, I wish we had a guy like Bo Nix. Like, you know, you never thought you'd say that 2 years ago, but it's like you wish you had a guy that, or I think every college football team, I think Alabama feels this way. You know, they wish they had a guy that's played a lot of football. And that's past the point of having moments where, oh, he hasn't experienced this before and he doesn't know how to respond. Like, mm-hmm. Bo Nix knows how to respond. Last year, Stetson knew how to respond because he's made his mistakes. He's done it already.
And in fact, you know, and at the end of the day, this is probably kind of brings us full circle to our NFL conversation, right? The, you know, if Fields and Wilson have NFL talent, the game slows down over time. It's just a matter, did they give it to him? Did they give him to too quickly and sort of kind of screwed up their heads versus, you know, letting them learn slowly, pick up the speed of the game, pick up the intricacies of the defense. It's, you know, it's an endlessly fascinating position. Now, of course, at the pro level, right? I mean, I think you make actually a really interesting point in some ways. You can always grab that senior quarterback in the portal now in the college ranks.
Yep.
And get that guy that's played a lot of football. But in the NFL, you're trying to maximize the snaps from when the guy's making $3 million a year before you have to start paying him $50 million a year.
I get that, but looking at like Jordan Love and looking at Patrick Mahomes and looking at some of the success stories of young quarterbacks, so to me still seems like the unless you have a great foundation with the offensive line to start a kid as a rookie, you know, to start a 20-year-old at quarterback in the NFL who's got a high ceiling tends to me to be, and maybe not, maybe it's just exposing something we would have learned 4 years later when they finally get their first start. But I have to believe like a kid like Fields would have benefited from a Jordan Love type situation.
I mean, and again, it's like kind of we can never do the counterfactual on this.
Yeah.
Would Trevor Lawrence have been better off watching that first year rather than playing? And, you know, he seems to have survived and looks like he's going to thrive. But, you know, and so it's this interest, you know, this is always the challenging thing where you want this level of sort of grit and resiliency that is essentially impossible to assess because very few of these guys have ever gone through anything like this, right? Because they've always been so hyper talented.
And I would say on the flip side that it's also tough to judge, like Daniel Jones, in my opinion, for the Giants. I thought he did. Everyone's been critical of him for forever. I thought he did a remarkable job his first three seasons of staying alive, of surviving, and of doing what he could with what he had. He's a really good quarterback at doing what you can with what you have when you don't have very much. So, you know, Saquon was out for a large stint of that, did not have a good offensive line, did not have an elite group of receivers or anything close to that. Like probably bottom five in the league receiver group, probably bottom five in the league offensive line for his first 3 years. That's tough for a young quarterback. And to survive that and have numbers that look mediocre is really impressive to me. But just because someone's mediocre with bad talent doesn't mean they're going to be great with good talent. And I think that's something that like a team like the Giants is figuring out or is probably concerned about right now that they have bolstered the line some and brought in some weapons. And it's like, oh, man, we're still seeing mediocrity out there.
Oh, man, we're going to be 8-9, 9-8 for the next 4 years, right?
Yeah, which is not what you want. So, again, it's a tough – I mean, the quarterback's a tough position, but the ideal situation, again, is that kind of – and I almost think the quarterbacks that succeed tend to be drafted a little later because they end up on better situations. Like Jordan Love, Packers is a good team. They've been a good team for a while. Mahomes inherited a really good team in Kansas City, and he wasn't a number one pick or anything close to that. And so being drafted by one of these bottom three or four teams, it's going to be several years before they have a competitive offensive line. The quickest turnaround we've seen is Joe Burrow in Cincinnati. And you know they kind of caught lightning in a bottle, I think. And we'll see long-term how things work out for him. But he's certainly one of the success stories of young quarterbacks starting right out the gate, with the exception of tearing his ACL's first year.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap it here.
I got one more thing, Mike.
Okay, what's that thing, Doug?
We talked about Oregon. We talked about Bo Nix. We talked about Dan Lanning. The Oregon Duck is one of my favorite mascots in sports. Yeah. I don't know why it's hilarious when he runs onto the field, and he runs onto the field every time. He's got those big old feet, and it's like he just looks so goofy. But one of my favorite things that happened in college football this week, and college football is great because there's just so much ridiculousness, silliness that happens. The Oregon Duck ringing some kind of bell or something where there was a pretty aggressive head movement involved. And there goes his head. And like any, you know, anyone with a secret identity, he had to cover his head and run out of the way as if he were Spider-Man or something. And it's very important that no one see the actual face. I found it interesting that he didn't just put the mascot head back on. But nonetheless, absolutely hilarious video. You know, he's had an interesting season. He had that game earlier. We had to do like 400 push-ups because they kept scoring points. Yeah. And I guess he did this week too, right? And so he's getting huge arms and he's super jacked and he doesn't, whoever the bodybuilder is under there, he cannot afford to have his identity revealed.
Wait, are we talking the Duck or did we switch back over to the BYU Cougar?
No, the Duck. The Cougar's great. Those are 1 and 2 for me. And I don't like in the mascots this year, mascot rankings.
The mascot Heisman competition needs to feature that. Needs to feature the BYU Cougar. I looked it up because, you know, when we start talking about the hat coming off and that kid staying in character. You know, that is a champion, right? The way he bowed his head, right? Like, you know, this is Clark Kent Superman stuff, Spider-Man without a mask, right?
Yeah.
And I too had forgotten what he was hitting, and it was a watch. It was a clock. So it was a direct shot at Colorado.
Nice.
So it was, you know, so Oregon, the program from the top down.
Yeah, all the way down to the mascot. Like they were committed. They were together. They're everything. I mean, that fan base is on fire right now. Keep an eye on Oregon out of the Pac-12.
Yeah, I'll tell you something funny about Oregon. And again, I mean, and this, we should probably wrap this up. That stadium always looks weird to me, right? Because they took that program from a nothing kind of program to, I guess, Nike's college football program. And that program, that stadium always looks too small.
Right? It is. I've been there.
50s, right? 50K, 55K or something?
Yeah, I've been there. It doesn't. It feels like a mini Rose Bowl. You know, it's that kind of one-tiered stadium, but very small. I was on a trip in the Pacific Northwest when I was in college, and I ran onto the field. No one was watching the gate, so just wanted to get out there. I've got pictures and stuff, but
which the Colorado players did too. Right, they went out there and they stomped on.
Yeah, I didn't do any stomping. I didn't want Dan Lanning sending his army of elite defenders after me. But this was pre-Dan Lanning though, so there was less to be afraid of. But yeah, I wasn't impressed being out there, and it does seem like they're long overdue. Like since the Chip Kelly days, long overdue for a stadium upgrade. Like they've got plenty of space out there. Add another deck.
Now, and they've been good enough, and they've got obviously enough backing. It's kind of interesting to me when I think about college football and the history of it. The schools that ended up with the 75, 80, 90, 100,000 seat facilities versus the ones that didn't, right? Those decisions to build the larger facilities, you know, in a weird way, it really seems like it's paid off, right? Because the mega stadiums outside of, let's say, USC, the history of the Coliseum, though, I don't know, have all got that kind of brand equity.
Well, if you go on Oregon's campus, like in my opinion, the campus is very underwhelming. Like growing up, going SEC campuses and stuff, and then their athletic facilities are clearly, it's like Nike built these things. Like they're state of the art, their basketball facilities, their, you know, their weight rooms, all the rest. And it's very contrasting walking on that campus and seeing, oh, this is where the students live and this is where the athletes live. You know, this is where they go to study and this is where they go to work out. And it's night and day. And so they have invested proportionally a lot into their sports programs and facilities. But it might just be the fact that it's in Eugene, and Eugene's 2 hours from Portland. I mean, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere, not a huge place.
It may well be the smallest stadium in terms of the semi-elite programs.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's wrap it there. Just over an hour. So like I said, a little Taylor Swift fandom analytics at the fandomanalytics.com page. We'll be back next week. Thank you.